Firefighting is essential for our communities, but it's never been easy. Today, with increased heat loads and toxicity, the job's more dangerous than ever before. At MSA, our health and safety drives them to develop highly advanced safety equipment to protect us on the job. MSA's Globe Gear is performance and protection in perfect balance. It's designed to meet the challenges we face every day and to keep us safe and healthy during our careers and beyond. Get the full story at msafire.com/globe.
Welcome to The Backstep, where we talk about safety, survival, and other things. Welcome to The Backstep.
Well, good evening, everybody. Welcome to The Backstep. This is Ronnie Kay out in New York, and Tommy A is on the phone with me, my partner, right out there in the Four Corners, but in New Mexico. And we got a guest with us tonight, Chief Mike West from Colorado. So, Tom, welcome aboard. Good to hear you, buddy. And what's going on out there?
It's always good to hear your voice, my friend. And I was going to blame Mike about the crappy conditions here in northwest New Mexico, because all the smoke from the Colorado fires has been coming down and seeping into the Four Corners. Thankfully, we haven't seen the fire activity that other folks around the state of Colorado and the folks in California have seen, but it is a season.
Yeah, I got it. Chief West, Mike, how you doing, pal?
I'm doing great, Ronnie. It's great to be with you guys. It's been a long time since it feels like forever since I've been on with both of you, and seems like it's been at least 6 or 8 months since I've been on at all. But it's great to hear you guys' voice, and things are going good.
Good, good.
I wanted to make sure that after Mike had gotten his phlebotomy, that he has kind of cleared it up and has fallen into the fire chief position.
He sounds pretty good to me. But we'll get back to that in a minute. Some of you may have heard at the very beginning, there was about 4 seconds of Bobby Halton's voice before the music started, and I inadvertently cut Bobby off. But the message was, we have a new sponsor for Blog Talk Radio, not only our show, but the entire Blog Talk Radio. The people at Globe and MSA Safety stepped up to the plate, and we really, really want to thank them truly for allowing us to continue the mission of sharing information and having these chats 5 nights a week. You know, that there's about 35 sets of DJs, so to speak, or hosts, if you will. And we had some sponsors in the past, and sponsors come and go, and we know that. But right now, the Globe MSA family has stepped up to the plate, and we truly, truly appreciate them doing that. So Globe MSA, thank you very, very much. We're glad you're on board, and we're glad you partnered with Block Talk Radio, Fire Engineering, and the rest of the groups that will be on later on, and of course the Clarion Events Company. So welcome aboard, and welcome to the show, Globe MSA. We look forward to doing some more stuff with you. All right, and I'll ask all our listeners to keep Globe and MSA in mind when you're considering your purchases in the future. So while that sounds like a commercial, it is. So with that,
hey,
yeah, it is.
I got to tell you my MSA story.
Sure.
Back when MSA bought Carnes Fire Helmets, I was out at FDIC, and I was getting ready to buy a new helmet because the one I bought in like 1976 was starting to show its age a little bit, and there was one of the Coons brothers was still working for MSA doing the Carnes Fire Helmet thing. And I said, you know, I bought a helmet from you guys a long time ago. I said, and I went to the factory and I had it custom fitted. And they put the metal spring-loaded derby on my head to punch the outline. And this guy looks at me and basically says, there's not many of you guys that are still alive. So I still bought the leather helmet from him, and the price jumped from like $53 in the 70s to almost $400 for the last one I bought, but it's still a great product, and we love the guys.
I had the spring-loaded, custom-fitted Derby on my head in 1974. I had the spring-loaded one on my head as well. So that's, I guess, maybe that's what pulled out all my freaking hair. I don't know. Who the hell knows?
But it fit in with the Buffalo Head story. Because when I put the Derby on, the guy told me not to move and was actually bringing people in from the factory to look at the size of my head.
I figured they might have said that you stretched out the springs and you broke it, or you maxed it out or something, right?
Yeah.
Do you actually have a hat size? Like, you know, most people are like, you know, 7 5/8 and 7 1/2. I mean, do you actually have a hat size or no?
Yes, so I'm a size 8.
So that's a bowling ball. That's not even a head. Jeez. Oh, mackerel. But anyway, so here we are all together. And I just getting back to Mike, you know, the first chief job that I had, and I had a couple, guy walked up to me and said, did you pass the marble test? It was one of the captains in the fire department. I said, what the hell is a marble test? He says, when they ask you if you want to be chief, he says, you fill up your mouth with marbles and spit it out one at a time. He says, and then when you lost all your marbles, you say yes, he said to me. So hopefully, Mike, you took the marble test and you lost all your marbles, and there you are. But how long have you been in the chief seat, Mike?
So 13 months now, actually almost 14 months. I started July 1st of 19. And, you know, I think we were talking right before we went live, just, I don't think anyone wants to get a job as a fire chief and then have their first major crisis be a global pandemic. But other than that, it's going really well, and I couldn't be happier.
Let me say something as much as I know you and we know each other a couple of years, there's probably no one better in that seat to shoulder something like this than a guy like you, Mike. So. Just you hang in there and keep doing your thing, and you be a fireman's chief, and you'll be fine. So congratulations to you. All right.
Thank you. Thank you, brother.
You're welcome. So what I think there's no doubt that I think that the first topic of tonight has to be what's going on out west. I mean, the guys in California absolutely getting their asses kicked. It's in Colorado. I think there's a couple of more states on fire, but I certainly am not. I'm not the wildland fire expert. I know, Tommy, you have you've done a series of articles in Fire Engineering on the Wildland Urban Interface, which we call WUI. And I know, Mike, you're out there WUI. Yeah, you're out there in Colorado now, and you've been in that region for a while. So I'm going to let you guys talk about it. And also, maybe you can hit upon that they said some of the fires might have been arson. And being a fire investigator and a teacher of fire investigation and arson investigation for many years in a community college, I would just kind of skirt the wildland because, frankly, teaching in New Jersey and Connecticut, there's a little bit of it, but it's not like being out west. So we kind of hit it, and whatever is said in the book, I would deliver to the students. But I'm not an expert by any means in that particular venue. So I'll turn it over to Tommy and talk about what's going on out west, and then maybe go into a little bit of the investigation. So go ahead, Tom.
You know, the fires, the two big ones up in Colorado going right now, got a lot of resources being pumped into it. And the stuff in California, and I hate to be this way, but it's almost like the media is shocked that there's this many wildfires going on. And I'm, you know, look back in history. We're not doing anything different. Especially when the Santa Ana winds start hitting the state of California, you know that anything that starts is going to turn into a major event. There were two things that I picked up on just kind of keeping an eye on things. One was back on July 30th, there was a midair collision of two single-engine air tankers in Nevada, down in the southeast portion of the state, at the Bishop Fire. And there was a preliminary report put out by the NTSB that I looked at, and it talked about a couple of things that kind of had me concerned. The preliminary report stated that one of the single-engine air tankers had gotten retardant on its windshield, and the two seats were working in tandem, and they had a lead plane that was leading them in to do a slurry drop. But, you know, looking at some of the stuff that NTSB put out, the one thing that didn't pop up, and Mike, I know with some of the larger fires, you guys have probably been in the same boat, but there should be an air attack plane up there to basically be the control tower in the air, if you would. And I didn't see anything in the NTSB report that said that there was a lead plane, or there was a lead plane, but that didn't say anything about there being an air attack up there, or whether that lead plane was filling both roles, if you would.
Yeah, that's a great question for sure, Tommy. I'm not sure. I didn't read the report, but you know, anymore, it seems like whether it's the Forest Service, BLM, or whoever's running the show, usually puts an air boss in place. They're highly qualified. They're basically air traffic control on these incidents. But I'll tell you, you know, Ronnie, I know you don't do a lot of this, but whether it's the weather, whether it's private planes, whether it's the news media, whether it's people flying their drones to get coverage, that is such a complex kind of thing when you're dealing with air assets, for sure.
I can only imagine. And you know what? This is going to fall under in my category, like, you're never too old to learn it. I didn't even know that they put an air boss up in the sky to almost act like the air traffic control, to say, all right, bring in plane number one, bring in helicopter number five. All right, they're gone. Bring in the next guy. And I didn't even know the only time I ever heard of that, actually, or the first time I heard of it, was the New Year's Eve fire in 1988 at the Puerto Rico hotel. Escapes my head what the name of the hotel was, but they had a fire on New Year's Eve. A lot of people perished in the fire. That's when we discovered that they were pumping oxygen into the casino, and the fire hit the casino and took off. And they were doing roof rescue at that particular one, and a military guy went up, you know, up to 5,000 feet, and he acted as the air controller, bringing in the helicopters. You go down to the beach, you go up to the roof, you go down to the beach, and he was acting as the air traffic. I didn't realize they did that regularly on wildland fires. I had no idea. It's a great idea.
Is that air boss up
in a helicopter, like just hovering at a certain altitude and just staying in one spot, or are they moving around, those guys?
Go ahead, Tommy.
They're generally moving around, and they're in a fixed-wing aircraft and not a helicopter. They're kind of overseeing the whole thing to make sure that nobody bumps into each other. And, I mean, this is tragic. Both pilots were killed.
It is tragic.
And I'm sure there's going to be other reports out that the one from the NTSB was pretty preliminary. But you know, in the Working with Aviation Resource article that I did for the WUI series, it talks about that particular portion of it. But it also kind of highlights the fact that, you know, guys working in the WUI who are pretty much just structural guys may not be familiar with some of the stuff that occurs when you start getting air resources in on an incident. And it's something that really requires a tremendous amount of situational awareness, especially when you're dealing with multiple radio frequencies. Who's doing what to who? Is the ground pounders clear for a retardant drop? A lot of things could go wrong in those operations. And unfortunately, we see an example here of some of the tragedies that can possibly occur.
Well, no dead air time, guys. There must be something else to talk about. What's going on? You know, how about the safety stuff? I mean, that's kind of our mantra here on the show. What about fire orders and what about all that stuff? I mean, you know, does it still work? Does it need to be, in your opinion, should it work? Could it be better? Is it something that's old that needs to be up to? You know, I don't know. You know, I know of it, but I never worked it.
It absolutely works. It's, you know what we do, Ronnie? It doesn't matter if it's structural or wirelands. As time goes on and maybe we get lucky and dodge the bullet for a while, we start thinking of other things that can get us. But when you look at the reports, no matter if it's structural or wireland, it always comes back to the basics. And truly, over the last few years, the tragedies all go back to those basics. And it's not just one, you know, you mess up on one watch out situation or what have you. They line up. And I know you guys have heard that Swiss cheese model, you know, the holes of the cheese line up perfectly. And yep. Now you have an event that passes through and they do work. They truly do. But the problem here is, you know, we got a fire right now. It's currently the second largest. I'll bet you today it's actually going to be the largest because it was just a couple thousand acres short of being the largest fire in Colorado history burning right now on the western slope. 900 firefighters working, tons of air assets, you know, weather conditions. People are tired. They've been out there. I just did a crew change. One of my firefighters came back today. We sent new firefighters out. So these people have been working for 2 weeks. They're tired. They're worn out. And all of a sudden you drop your guard and something happens. So they're very, very complex incidents that last a long time. And the air assets is a very complicated piece, but it's only one piece.
Yeah, I'm sure. You know what? Interestingly enough, you know, when I did my fire officer's guide to occupational safety and health last year for fire engineering, I did the book. I got a little bit into wildland, and I did research, and I spoke to a couple of people, and of course Tommy was one of them, and then I looked at fire orders, and I did a comparison to structural using fire orders, and it's close, like you said, Mike. It's a lot of the stuff is the same, you know. It's basic stuff. But I remember I did that comparison in the book, and a couple of people said to me that was an interesting thing. I said, but you know what? If you look at it, you know, there are some anomalies in the wild, and there's no doubt about it. There's no doubt that I'm thinking weather is probably the number one. Wind and weather is probably the number one thing that people are looking out for. But a lot of the other stuff is fairly close. It's fairly close. Not to finish out this show that we didn't complete everything that we started out to talk about. That was the DuPont Plaza Hotel in Puerto Rico in 1988. I had to give you the name of the hotel. Sorry, guys, but we got to be complete.
Thank you.
Here.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
if you take the time and go back and look at the first set of basically kind of standing orders that the IAFC came out with, the rules of engagement, and the 10 standard firefighting orders and 18 watch-out situations, there's definitely a correlation there. And there's lessons to be learned from both ends of the spectrum. I distinctly remember when I found out that there was a way, there's a procedure for a wildland guy to turn down an assignment. And a lot of it's based on not only conditions, but also the expertise of the crew that's being assigned to that. And I can fondly remember back to Battalion Chief Jack Ross in Milburn, New Jersey, and thinking of the poor bastard that said to him, Chief, I don't think that would be a safe assignment. My crew's never done that. They'd still be pulling pieces of his boot out of your ass. but I think it's something that we've gotten smarter about, and we need to think about making sure that the resource that we are assigning matches the objectives of the task, and we're not putting people in peril doing some of that.
Well, you know, Tom, and that parallel is to what I've preached on the fire ground as a chief when I'd say to my newest guy and my senior guy, if you see something, let me know. You know, I might not see it. So, you know, if you're on the roof or you're inside and you see something that's bad, you got to tell me. You know, everybody's empowered. This is about empowerment. And it sounds like the wildland guys are getting that empowerment now. And our structural guys just started to get it a little while ago. But it's that, you know, everybody's kind of a safety officer, and everybody's got to be looking out for the guy next to him or gal next to her, trying to keep it even, to say, hey, we think we got a problem or we're about to have a problem. We need to change gears here, change direction, get out, go left, go right, whatever it is. So I think from a safety standpoint, I think we're all finally kind of coming to the same page. You know, the Fallen Firefighters Foundation, you know, with our 16-year-old program already, everyone goes home, courage to be safe. You know, we're just starting to infiltrate the wildland groups. We're working with Tom Harbor, who just retired from as the I think he was the chief of the Wildland Fire Service, at least the Western Hemisphere over there. And Tom's a great asset for us, man. I mean, he knows that stuff, you know, backwards and forwards, and he's helping us pave our way into the wildland firefighting community to deliver courage to be safe into the wildland, and it's working. We've already done a bunch of pilots, and the good news is they're very receptive. The wildland firefighters that have come to those classes and have sat for whether it's train to trainer or just the good old courage to be safe 4-hour block, they're very receptive. It's like, wow, this is great stuff. So we're making some great inroads with the wildland community in terms of safety, which makes me kind of happy. And I know it makes them happy also, you know, including the new bosses and stuff like that. So I would love for you guys to comment a little bit about the method by which they can kind of do a fire investigation leading possibly to an arson out there. So Tom, I'm going to kick it back to you because I know you're my arson guy and my wildland guy together. Yeah. So let me put you on a spot in front of the entire United States, if you don't mind.
Yeah, no problem. And I'll be the first one to tell you that my skills in investigating wildland fires are not anywhere near close to those guys that do it all the time, and it's almost like a. I would describe it as a art within a science. What they're looking at, direction of fire travel, examining the lighter fuels to see which way stalks and stems fall, looking at trees to see which side is burned more than others, kind of correlates into some of the stuff that we see in the structural firefighting. But without walls, you're looking at a whole different set of evidence to try to lead you to where the fire started. You know, the thing you may want to look at is kind of towards the heel of the fire and looking at the flanks and examining what's left of fuels in the area to try to make a determination of which way this fire came from. And if we get down to certain areas, hopefully look for evidence of either an accidental fire cause or an incendiary fire. But you got to be pretty tenacious to get out there and do that with some of the fuels out there and try to not miss anything in that huge arena of evidence that you're looking at. I have nothing but respect for the guys that do that and are able to make a call. I can't help but point out that one of the most prolific fire investigators in the wildland was a guy named John Orr. And for those of you who have not read Fire Lover by Joseph Lombard, John Orr was one of the most prolific serial arsonists in the United States while he was working for the fire department. And I kept thinking that kind of gave him an unfair advantage of doing origin and cause on fires that he started. Obviously, he didn't have any trouble figuring out where that one started.
I know the John Orr story pretty well. And you know, and as a side note, Tommy, you know, for you to sit there and say, admittedly, I'm not the guy, and then go on for 10 minutes and kind of tell tell us and the listening audience everything there is to know about doing a kind of investigation, you need to re-examine your own stuff, because it sounds like you certainly either know what you're doing or you're faking it. I don't think so. You're not a guy that fakes it. You're the real deal. So I appreciate your knowledge base, man. That's good stuff. I don't know, Mike, have you had the occasion to do any investigation on wildland stuff out in Colorado?
No, just as an incident commander trying to, you know, preserve the point of origin and all that. You know, one of the things, Ronnie, kind of that really makes it challenging, I think, for the investigators is the length of time that some of these incidents go on, you know. So this back to this fire on the western slope, right now it's burned over 200 square miles and it's been burning for 2 weeks. You know, so think about that. That's almost, you know, that's two-thirds the size that a city of New York has burned. And but the key there is you got to go back to the day it started and trying to preserve that spot on the day it started as best you can. And these guys will use apps and look at, you know, what were the weather conditions? Were there any lightning strikes going on? You know, what are the campgrounds in the area? Are there any now one of the things with all of our investigation really is the video cameras. Is there any surveillance video, cars in the area, that type of stuff? And we have some great technology, but you still got to go back to, man, that very first day, as close as you can get it down to a square mile. It's a lot better than 200 square miles, you know.
No doubt. They said yesterday in the news that the amount of California that's burned is equal to the size of the state of Rhode Island, you know. And
yeah,
while Rhode Island is the smallest state in the country, okay, I've been to Rhode Island, and if the whole state of Rhode Island was on fire, I can imagine what that fire looks like on the West Coast. That's incredible. That's an incredible amount of fire. It's crazy. It's crazy.
You know, the fire that's burning up there outside of Grand Junction, Mike, I was up in Junction about a week and a half ago looking at a fire. And I think they were trying to manage that one back then. I was maybe a day or three into the incident, and I kept thinking, man, that looks bad. I had the opportunity to have lunch with another New Jersey American, Frank Cavalier, the fire chief up in Fruta, Colorado. And I guess the fire had bumped pretty much right next to Frank's district, and I know they've been involved in it. But again, the length of time that it takes to get those types of incidents contained never ceases to amaze me as to everything you got to pump into it to try to get a line around that thing.
So in terms of the wildland fire season, is this like the beginning of the season we're in?
No, we're about, I'm going to say, probably about halfway through.
About halfway through. Jeez. So basically more to come, right, so to speak?
Yeah. You know, especially with some of the weather anomalies going on, I can't remember the last time it rained here. They're talking about some of the tropical storms that are going to be blowing up through the south may bring us some relief in the high temperatures and actually provide some precipitation, but I'll believe it when I see it.
Yeah, that would be nice. The brothers and sisters down in Louisiana are going to get a 1-2 punch as of this afternoon. It's today they're getting a tropical storm, 45 mile an hour winds, a couple inches of rain, and then in the next 48 hours, Laura's coming up and it's going to hit them in the same spot, but she's coming up as a Cat 2, Cat 3, so they're really going to have their hands full. Right in the center of the country. It's coming right up to Louisiana, Mississippi, and all that stuff. The thing is, those storms normally take a right turn and head out back toward the Atlantic. It's like a magnet. The Atlantic pulls it right. Even if it hits the center of the country, it pulls it to the right. It never goes left. So it's going to be a fat chance that you're going to see any of that. It's unfortunate, but I know you guys can use the rain out there. And as you know, Tommy, my sister lives in Albuquerque, and I talk to her every day, every single day, and she tells me how hot and dry it is, and they haven't seen any rain. I think they had rain 2 weeks ago in Albuquerque for about a day, and it was just kind of showery, but that's about it. You know, not enough to make a difference, that's for sure.
No. So I came across another interesting article, and it was on the Billy G's website, and it was back from July 18th, and right after we did our last show. And I don't know whether you saw it, Ron, but there was a fire chief in California that's been charged with manslaughter in a wildland fire death. It was the Berea fire in California. And even though the article didn't really provide any specifics of what they were looking at, Kurt Verone had some stuff up on his website. Just kind of speculating that this could relate to issues with command, control, communications, and accountability. And I'm interested in keeping an eye on this one, just to see where they're coming from with the fire chief being charged in a criminal matter for manslaughter.
Tommy, I did see something on it, and this is. This is nothing new. I mean, this has been rearing its ugly head in this unbelievable litigious society that we live in, especially the last 20 years when people sue for hot coffee in their lap, even when they're drinking hot coffee. We've been talking about this. I know Billy G writes a lot about the liability on the fire chief, you know, when things go bad. And sometimes it's civilians suing because a family member was killed in a house and they charged the fire department with, you know, negligence or being unprepared and all that kind of stuff. So I'm not shocked. I mean, I'm not surprised anymore, but this is something that, you know, it's where we live. It's the time that we're living in now.
I understand the part of the civil liability, And if there's negligence on the part of the fire department, they're going to have to get called to task on some of this. But this is, I think, the second time that I recall there being a criminal indictment. The first one was the Lairdsville, New York training accident, the training officer got charged criminally, and now this again. I'm interested to see how this one's going to shake out.
Yeah, I think in the Lairdsville accident, the assistant chief who was running the drill he got 5 years.
Yeah,
he got 5 years. So that was really the first one that was the shot across the bow. You know, that was kind of the first one. I was like, oh God, really? So, in a good way, it's like, well, yeah, we need to pay attention. We need to not kill anybody at training. You know, so I kind of, you know what I'm saying? But I don't know. It's interesting times. And yeah, we probably need, everybody needs to keep an eye on that story to see how it comes out. But at the same time, everybody needs to pay attention on the fire ground and to their training and their abilities and inabilities and all that other stuff to make sure that they don't run into that problem. Make sure we got the right people in the right spot at the right time, you know? Chief West, any comments from you, sir?
No, and I think at the end of the day, we can't be paralyzed by fear, by, you know, what lawsuits or what we might be charged with. Do your very best, be a student of the game, and constantly, you know, question and re-question your policies and procedures and your training, and keep trying to make it better and do the right thing. And I certainly hope that we're not ever going to be under the scrutiny that our law enforcement brothers and sisters are in.
Oh my God! Mike, you make a great point.
Right?
You make a great point about not being handcuffed to do the best job we can do and get out there and sick. We don't want to second guess ourselves, but I think so. That's important. You know, that incident commanders and officers can get out and make decisions on the fire ground without being worrying about, well, gee, what if I get sued? But I think the emphasis has to be on training and preparedness and all that stuff to make sure that we're doing the very best that we can to prepare those people to be in the street and to do what they need to do.
Absolutely. I think you put it really well, Ronnie, and I guess I would say, you know, respect and be concerned with always trying to do your very best, but don't be paralyzed with fear.
And, right.
That's worse to me. That's far worse than anything that they can do to us.
Right. We don't want to get into that paralysis by analysis. Don't you love that saying? I love that paralysis by analysis. But you know what? Some people get caught in that, even in administratively. I worked with a deputy who was basically that he was on an administrative level at a fire ground. He was terrific, but administratively, he was paralysis by analysis, man. He was tied up in knots all the time in the office. So I try to break him of the habit, but it doesn't. Old habits die hard. We know how that goes, right? I guess we can kind of move. I got a couple of things. Yeah, you got something, because I got 95 things, but you go ahead.
We'll get to you. Relax. new National Fire Academy superintendent.
That was on my list. You see, I could have said that one, but I didn't.
Okay. Well, I'll let you talk about it.
No, I'm not saying a word now. Tough shit. Now it's on you.
Yeah.
Actually,
yeah,
Eric's Gablix, and it's not Eric, it's Eric's Gablix. I guess that's an old
another displaced Jersey kid.
Yes, from New Jersey originally, and what I told Tommy the other day, what he didn't know was his brother was the state forester, was the state wildland forest guy.
Maris Gablix,
that's correct. When I was active in New Jersey as a chief, we invited him to be part of the Fire Chiefs Association, and he'd come to a meeting now and then. But he's retired from the State Forest Service in New Jersey. But Eric's was at the. Do you know him, Mike?
I know him well. He was my boss when I was a dispatcher in Monmouth County, New Jersey.
Well, how about that?
Eric was in town here in Denver just about. I don't know, it must have been about 10 months ago, and we got together and had breakfast. And I will tell you that even as a young man, he was in his early 20s, he was a dispatch supervisor. One of the most brilliant minds I've ever met. Foresight, visionary, outstanding guy. And he shared with me back then that he was looking at maybe, making a move. And I'm just so proud that he's done that. He's going to do a great, great job with that. And you guys appreciate this. They were both Maris and Eric's were volunteers with Harry Carter in Howell Township, New Jersey. So.
Wow.
Yeah. I saw that on Eric's his bio's online now because he got named. So they showed his history, Howell Township. And yeah, I saw all of that. But we're going to have to go with your endorsement, Mike, because I only met him once or twice in person for about 10 minutes each time. And Tommy never met him. So we're going to have to go with your endorsement that we're going to be looking for big things coming out of him from the National Fire Academy.
Seriously, I'll stand by that endorsement in a heartbeat. He's a stellar individual, and I know he's going to do a great job.
All right, good. Good. We'll have to look forward to a bright future at the National Fire Academy. I know Tanya was holding the torch for both jobs for a while. I'm sure she's relieved that he's been named, but he's not going there till November. So that's probably because it takes the federal government many, many, many months to get everything in order, like as usual. When she got hired to the superintendent's job, it took them a year to get her on board. It took them a year to board her up. So he's going in November, and we'll look forward to good things. That's all we could do, right? So you brought up Harry Carter's name publicly right here on the air. We want to. Harry's very under the weather at the moment. He's being treated for brain cancer, but they're hopeful, and we're hopeful too. And we want to send our best to our good friend Harry Carter from retired out of Newark, New Jersey, and a man about town, prolific writer and lecturer and teacher and instructor and all that stuff. And he's been around as probably longer than me. He's been around forever, we'll just say, you know. And we want to wish him good luck, good health, and get him back on his feet again as soon as possible. So good luck, Harry, and we're all rooting for you. I know I speak for a lot of folks when I say that. Tommy, you used to ride with him in Newark or something, right? Didn't you used to buff with him?
Yeah.
You got Tommy, you got to tell the suburban seat story. Now's the time.
Now, back in the day, Harry and I were very large people. And he was, I think, in the riding as the 1st Battalion Chief, and he was in an old Chevy Suburban. And those familiar with the North Fire Department know of the quality of their equipment. And we got in the Suburban. Harry put the Suburban in drive and stepped on the gas pedal, and the bolts holding the seat to the floor broke. And we both fell back, and our feet were up in the air, kind of dangling. And thank God Harry got the Suburban stopped. But I think we ended up kind of supporting those seats with milk crates between the back of the front seat and the front of the back seat. And we pretty much spent the rest of the night riding around like that.
Hey, Mike, can you picture that? These two guys with their feet up in the air like turtles on their backs, right?
Roddy, I had to put it on mute because I was laughing so hard because I can picture it perfectly, actually.
That's hysterical. I can't wait to see Harry in person again, hopefully maybe at FDIC next year, and to ask him to rehash his part of the story. But, yeah, good guy. And, you know, Harry's Harry. He's, you know, he's bigger than life. He has a big personality. I told him once or twice to check his ego at the door going into a meeting in New Jersey when we were both active there, and he did. But I invited him when I was president of the Instructor Society. We had some conferences. I invited him to speak, and he's always a hit, you know. So, and his contributions to the fire service, not just in New Jersey, but on a national level, especially through the highway safety gang there, respondersafety.com or whatever they are. And they do great stuff, and he's part of that gang, and his contributions have just been outstanding. So, again, Harry, we wish you well. Come back soon. We want to see you up and on your feet so we can make fun of you again. You know, how else are we going to do it? let me see what else I have. A couple things written down. Just as an aside, you know, we talk about training and safety. Some of the things I'm doing for the National Fallen Firefighters for the benefit of the listening audience, you can get on to, we have something called the Fire Hero Learning Network, FHLN.com, Fire Hero Learning Network. And there are a dozen online courses on that. They're 1 hour, and we cover a lot of subjects. We cover for office, company officer and command, and we cover safety, of course, and a whole bunch of great video on AAR, after action reviews. And we got a 3-star general out of the Army to lecture on that. And they're 1 hour, and he talks about the AAR, and he talks about the fact that, you know, everybody gets a little excited, you know, when they get together after an incident, because then no one wants to be blamed, and it's not about blame. It's about being better. And God, the Blue Angels do it, and the Marines do it, and the SEALs do it. We can do it also. So there's some neat stuff on there. There's a gaggle of fire ground checklists, and I'm actually working on that now. I'm currently the training and education coordinator for the foundation, so we're updating some of those programs that are online. We've updated all of our regular deliveries. Everyone goes home, covers to be safe, LAC, LEGH, all those programs that we're doing that revolve around everyone goes home and the coverage to be safe programs. We've been doing some of them online, actually. We're doing virtual, but when things loosen up, we're going to start traveling the country again. But there are online programs. It's free. You just got to go in there and register, and you can watch them at home and in the firehouse and whatever, and get some free education and food for thought and firehouse drills and that kind of stuff. So head at it. It's FHLN, Fire Hero Learning Network, FHLN.com. So take a look at that.
So I had a note for you, Ron, because I noticed that both the Foundation and Stonehouse Media just released when an LODD occurs, incident commanders speak. And was that one of your projects?
No, that was in the making before me, and Ian Bennett. Ian Bennett, who's now working for the foundation, Ian's a retired chief out of Harrisonburg, Virginia. He took over we have a couple of one of the new programs we have is IC to IC, incident commanded incident, because we've had a chief to chief network for a long time. when there was a line of duty, we would connect that chief with a chief that had a line of duty, so so the chief can have some support himself, because he or she is running around taking care of everybody else. But now we connected them with another chief, and that helps. So we graduated it to another program, IC to IC. The incident commander that loses a firefighter might be a battalion chief, could be a district chief, could be a captain. So we started IC to IC, and what Ian did was he put together a series that they're doing online now that we get incident commanders on that had a line of duty, and they talk about the fire and talk about how they handled it and stuff. He had Steve Reynes on recently to talk about the Deutsche Bank fire in Manhattan, where two firefighters got killed in that. And then there's others. So there's a series, the IC to IC incident command series are coming up. That's something that Ian Bennett's handling. Plus, Ian's now the nationwide coordinator for the 50 state local assistance state teams, the 50 teams. And he's kind of corralling everybody there. And again, as soon as things lighten up, we've been having meetings online, but we want to get out around. I'm part of the training team for those teams. We get out around the country and we do some training and prepare them to respond and react. So there's a bunch of stuff on there. Try that Fire Hero Learning Network. You might find a couple of tidbits and a couple of good pearls in there, pearls of wisdom maybe, perhaps. While we're on the foundation, as most of you know, we've talked about it before, this year's Fallen Firefighters Memorial cannot happen because of COVID. So similar to what law enforcement had done in May, we have a professional, a high-level TV and video team that's putting together a recorded tribute to the Fallen Firefighters of 2019 that will run at 10 a.m. on Memorial Sunday, October 4th. It'll be streamed out everywhere. I don't know if it's going to make network television yet or cable, but it'll definitely be streamed out over the Internet. So the team's working on it now, and while they're doing that, myself and the rest of the command team, and, of course, as most of you know, Tommy Ehrenheim is our operations chief for the Memorial weekend. We've been having regular meetings since March, and the decision of the board of directors of the foundation is that next October, a year from October, we're going to do a two-year ceremony live in Emmitsburg. So we're going to have the families of the 2019 LODDs and the families of the 2020s. So we're going to have a heavy lift next year, but I've worked with this team for 20 years. And we've done some unbelievable stuff together as a team. It's truly the A team. It's an honor for me to work with these people every single year to get stuff done. So next year we'll have a heavy lift, but we'll lift it, you know, and we'll get it done, and we'll honor the families properly for 2019 and 2020. So that's kind of where we're at. But October 4th of this year, there will be a video tribute, probably running about an hour. We will honor those firefighters who fell on the line of duty in 2019. What else do we have here on the magic pad? A part of that, by the way, last couple of years, we've been working on this project called Light the Night. And that weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, we've asked fire departments and major landmarks to light up red. And every year, it's getting a little bit bigger. You know, fire stations are doing it and stuff like that. And they put a red light bulb outside, you know, or a red spot on the bay doors or something. But we got landmarks. I mean, last year we had the Sears Tower and the Empire State Building in New York, and we're getting big landmarks to do it. So we're asking to do, since we can't get together in person, we're going to try a one-week Light the Night starting September 27th to October 4th. So I'll ask everybody listening to the program, if you're not the chief of your department, go back to your chief and say, hey, can we just get one of them spots and put it up on the bay doors, put it up on the front door at night, and run it for a week as part of a tribute and light up the night for the fallen firefighters from 2019. So there's more about it. The foundation's website is firehero.org, firehero.org, and you can get a whole bunch of stuff on there. So we're also looking at what the federal government's doing. It looks like the president signed a bill recently to recognize COVID line-of-duty deaths as long as the responder contracted it within 45 days. In other words, if they believe that they had a patient, or they were in an ambulance, or they went to a hospital and delivered a patient, if they had exposure and were diagnosed within 45 days and then passed from COVID, that would qualify as a line of duty and could lead to the PSOB benefits. But the foundation is watching it very closely, because if that's the case, if they recognize it, we're going to recognize it. So as we unfortunately have our regular or normal, what I call normal line of duties, you know, people getting trapped in a collapse, running out of air, you know, the heart attacks, the stuff we've been dealing with for many years that we're trying to make smaller and less. The COVID deaths may be added to the roster, and the cancer deaths, as we know, they're recognizing the FDNY guys that are dying from Trade Center cancer, and other, the board of directors of the foundation are now recognizing if a firefighter dies of cancer and the state that they come from recognizes that as a line of duty, the foundation will also. So when we look at all of that together for next year's ceremony, we could be looking at 200, 225, 250 names and families. So that's why we have the heavy lift, so to speak, next year. So we're monitoring all this stuff very closely, and there's a lot of stuff going on right now behind the scenes and a lot of other things. I did note, I saw online, Tommy, that our good friend Vito Maggiolo from Washington, D.C., he's got a regular podcast going on out of Washington on another Fire Magazine's website, which we're not allowed to talk about because we can get beat up in the stock room for that. But, yes, I've seen Vito's picture pops up on that thing anytime I go in there to look for something. And sure enough, and I mentioned Vito because he was part of our Memorial Weekend team for many, many years. He's been in and around D.C. area a long time. He's a big-time fire buff, and now he works for the D.C. Fire as the PIO. He got a great job. Good for him. We were rooting for him, and he's been here a couple of years already. But Vito actually would coordinate mobile canteens. You know, we got the honor guard pipes and drums rehearsing all day Saturday, going across the campus, and it's a hot day or whatever. They're bringing a couple of canteens, feed the guys, whether it's cold drinks, hot coffee, something to eat. We got them in there on Sunday. If we go off campus for rain and we go down to a university down the block and we use the gym, they come on Sunday and they take care of also the honor guard pipes and drums. And so Vito's been a great help and a great asset to us. And he when he got the job as PIO, he turned it over to another guy who's been doing a good job for us as well. So, but yeah, I saw Vito's picture came up. It scared me a little bit, but then I realized it was him, and you know, it's all good. You know that alternate site there.
He does such a great job with being the PIO. You know, I follow DC Fire kind of close because I really like Buffin, their department, and he's got a Twitter account set up for DC Fire, and apparently his name got changed a little bit from Vito to Tweedo. And
I like that.
It's a great deal.
That's very funny.
It's a great deal for keeping up with what's going on with DC Fire. And
Tweedo.
Yeah, Vito's got a hell of a background in media and communications. He was, before he retired, he was the assignment editor for CNN and the D.C. Bureau. But he has literally traveled all over the world covering stories for CNN. And I was so happy to see that D.C. Fire took those talents and basically put it to work for them. And he's doing a great job of providing some great press for that organization.
Cool. Yeah, and you know what? They kind of need any kind of good PR that they can get, because the DC Fire guys, I've seen them get beat about the head so many times, internally, externally, and they can use some good PR and other kind of stuff. So he's in the right spot at the right time. He's a good man.
I'm sure you remember when the Rube was over there, and we were in communication when he told me that he was going to go to D.C. Fire, and I suggested to him that he might want to find an easier problem to solve, like peace in the Middle East or building a highway between California and Hawaii. That would have been much simpler stuff than what he was dealing with.
A a lot easier. Absolutely a lot easier. So I agree. I agree. But he found himself a little niche in Pennsylvania out there in Marion Township. He's working with, you know, I can never remember that guy's name, and I know him such a long time. The guy from VFIS. He's, you know, the tall guy that's a fireman. You know him, Tom, right? I can't remember his name. I never remember his name. As soon as we hang up and we're off the air, I'll remember his name. But he's surrounded with good people, and he's building a small career fire department where it was traditionally volunteer for many, many years because the area has grown so much. So we bumped into him in Philadelphia last year when the foundation ran a couple of day seminar on technology and what's coming down the pike. And Philadelphia hosted us. Adam Thiel, the new commissioner down there, he did a great job, him and his people hosting the conference and stuff. And we were hoping to go back this September, but that ain't going to happen. But we're actually talking about doing it maybe virtual. You know, everybody who was there thought it was worthwhile, and they said, hey, we'll come back again next year. So if we can get some of most of those folks on a Zoom conference for a day or two and have, you know, enough guest speakers and talk about technology and the fire service, we're looking at it now. We've got somebody looking into it pretty heavily to see if we can pull it off, so to speak. But other than that, you know, we talk about training and safety and stuff on this program. I couldn't help but write it down and have to mention that mega blast in Beirut that killed those 10 or 11 firefighters was just it took the wind out of my sails. You know, that's their 9/11 over there. You know. And it was just a horrible, horrible. And of course, there's a picture up on another website that has, you know, there's three of them are breaking, going and trying to just force a door, an overhead door, minutes before that blast went off and killed those three, and there was a whole bunch of others. So we don't have an international audience, but I you know, when a firefighter gets killed anywhere, it affects all of us. You know, especially when it's en masse, you know, like 10 at a time and that kind of stuff. Billy G is good at keeping his ear to the ground, and a lot of people send him stuff, but he posts that, you know, if a firefighter gets killed in China or Sri Lanka or Spain or Australia, you know, and these 10 or 11 went in one shot in that blast over there in Beirut. But it seems that they have some accountability with the people who ran the facility, with the government, you know, and that kind of stuff, and on it goes. So I think we just take a second to pause for those firefighters who were killed in that blast. And while we're kind of on that subject, I haven't spoken to an urban setting chief in a while, but what's going on now in the large cities? You know, I mean, there's arson every single night. Portland's going on, what, 75 days of arson? It's like an arson contest out there. Portland, Seattle, New York, a whole bunch of others. We had an uprising, I think, in Michigan last night because there was another shooting, a police shooting. So it's getting crazy out there, you know, and just from my little spot in my little chair in northern New York, north of the city. Okay. What my message to everybody is: keep your head down. Just keep your head down. And I know some of you have gone out and bought ballistic equipment in the event of active shooter. To me, this is active shooter. If I was in that city and I was sending firefighters out to go to those fires, okay, they're either waiting until it's cleared, or if they gotta go in because there's a life hazard, they're gonna be wearing their ballistic equipment. They're wearing that vest under the coat, man. You know, because you gotta bring everybody home. You know, Mike, you're an active, of the three of us, you're the active fire chief in charge of a lot of men and women at this point, you know, and if you're in that city, Mike, how are you doing it? What are your thoughts? I'd love to know.
No, we have this talk even, you know, I'm not in the city anymore. I'm in a small fire district, but even in a small fire district, you know, the police officers right now, they're under such scrutiny that in some cases they're holding back, you know, not maybe being as aggressive. And if someone's having a mental issue and they don't want to put hands on them. And so that leaves you in this weird spot. This person needs some medical attention, but you may not be getting the support from the police officers because they're concerned about their liability or their issues. and it's got us all in this very, very weird place right now. We're a BLS agency. We don't carry narcotics, but some of the agencies that are carrying narcotics in Colorado are under a lot of scrutiny right now. So it's a very tough time, very, very tough time, and trying to figure out the right thing to take care of the patient and make sure that you're not in danger and make sure that everyone comes home. It's really challenging.
All right, so, Chief, I'm going to put you on the spot. Okay, you're the chief in Portland, Oregon. Are your guys wearing bulletproof vests under their coats today?
You know, it's tough to say, Ronnie. I understand where you're coming from, but, man, I'll tell you what. I have a bulletproof vest. I have tactical gear from my previous department. It's a lot of weight. It does not shed heat. And, you know, do we cause an additional issue with our guys and gals wearing heavy tactical vests underneath a bunker coat? I don't know. That would be a tough one. That would be a really tough one.
Well, maybe perhaps going into the zone. Maybe they need to do it in the zone and not necessarily automatically. But that's a tough call, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but too bad I did. But at the end of the day, those are the calls that chiefs are making now. Those are the types of calls that they're making. Or go, no go. You know, stage three blocks away until the cops say it's okay, come on in. Because, you know, at the end of the day, we didn't sign up for that. We did not sign up for that. So I think the fire chiefs in those cities and in those locations, they got their hands full right now trying to make good decisions, you know, and I don't envy them at all.
No, and it's,
all right,
it's
Tommy,
one of those things that the,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, Ronnie, at the end of the day, whatever your decision is, someone will view it as wrong, and that's what we get paid the big bucks for is to take
right.
that. Right. And I always say, you guys have heard me say it, if you're talking behind my back, you're in a great place to kiss my butt. So I'm okay with it. You know, I do the best.
I love it. That's great.
You know, you
That's
do the best
great.
You can with the information that we have and make the best call that you can to keep everyone safe.
That's all you could do. And you're right. No matter what decision a chief makes, he's going to come under scrutiny from somebody, whether it's his own people, the town fathers, the city hall people, or the citizens. So you just got to do the best you can with the information you have. That's good advice, I guess. And you got to stay engaged. You got to be fully engaged, and that situational awareness is key right now. It is so key. Mike, what we normally do at the end is Tommy reads the roll since we were on the air last. Tommy, you have that prepared tonight?
Yes, I do. The last time we were on the air was July 13th. On July 20th, Jason Cuffey of Charleston, West Virginia, died of an unknown medical at the station. On July 20th, Leroy Lucio from Houston, Texas, was a COVID-19 death. July 21st, Justin Robinson from Harrelson County, Georgia, died from a heart attack at a scene. July 25th, Jose Perez, L.A. City, California, a COVID-19 death. August 2nd, Stephen Splane from Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, heart attack at the station. August 3rd, Geraldo Pacheco from Houston, Texas, a COVID-19 death. August 4th, Anthony Christensen from Naples, Florida, a COVID-19 death. August 4th, Alec Tannenbaum from Vales Gate, New York, had a heart attack at home after work. August 8th, Eric Hayashi from Hilo, Hawaii, had a heart attack on the scene. And lastly, on August 11th, Peter Hine from Big Pine, California, also a heart attack at a scene. As always, I ask that you keep their families in your thoughts and prayers and heed some of the lessons learned that these guys have left for us to look at.
Thanks, Tom. We want to thank our special guest, Chief Mike West from Colorado, for jumping on the back step with us tonight. Mike, as always, it's a pleasure to talk to you and to chat with you, and hopefully we're all going to get together someday and see each other and maybe have a beer together. So thanks for coming on with us, and we appreciate you, okay?
Thank you so much. I always love talking with you guys.
All right, great.
Still talking to
you, So with that, it's a little late. I'm not going to give my normal going out tonight, but don't forget, wear your seatbelts, buckle up, and kiss your family and hug your kids and your wife tight before you go to bed every night, because we don't know what tomorrow is going to bring. Stay safe, everybody, and keep your head down. Good luck.